I was once lost, but now I'm found. Listen to John Schaefer on Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Music can do different things for different people. For some musicians and writers, hearing the music of Iggy Pop for the first time, the man who predates punk and now threatens to outlive it, was an unforgettable experience, and they'll share those memories with us later. For the award-winning poet and novelist Carl Hancock Rux, music is the beating heart of his writing. He's about to release his fourth album, and he and members of his band will play some of it for us live. But for people who suffer from hyperacusis, music, and in fact almost any sound, even the rustling of a newspaper, can be unbearably painful. We'll hear from a writer who suffers from this rare condition. So, what can music do for premature babies? Well, you might think, nothing. What would a baby know about music? Not so fast. Turns out that music, and specifically music therapy, can be very useful to a premature baby. So says a recent study from Beth Israel Medical Center here in New York. The leader of that study is Dr. Joanne Lowy. She joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Joanne, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What was the point of this study? What were you hoping to find out?
Well, we had known from the literature review that we did and from years of doing this work that infants in the womb recognize when they come out their parents' voice. So we knew that, and we also know that lullabies and melodies that are familiar to one's culture can be soothing and grounding for infants and children of any age. So what we wanted to do was really extend what's already in the literature and see what exactly is it about these lullabies? What about the meter, the timbre? So we pulled out these three interventions, the whooshing sounds of the womb, the heartbeat.
You mean recreating
instrumentally
that whooshing sound?
Yes, and the melody that they might have heard or that would at least be known in their culture.
So that suggests that by the time a baby is born, even a premature baby, they are already beginning a sort of process of acculturation, that there are certain types of sound that they recognize as theirs, as being music, even though obviously they don't have terms, you know, to describe it.
Yes, the womb is actually quite an active soundscape between the whoosh of the uterus and the heartbeat.
You have a couple of little noisemakers here in the studio.
Actually, we don't even call them drums because we don't use them as drums. We use them as sounds entrained to the baby's live vitals.
So one of these recreates that whooshing sound that
yes,
you're talking about?
Yes.
Which one?
This is the Remo Ocean Disc. It's a round circle. It's about 3 inches tall, and inside it are lots of metal beads. And when you move it around slowly, it makes a whooshing sound, and you can control how fast or slow you move it by watching the baby's breath. So you can actually elongate the baby's breathing in the moment.
So that process that that's neuroscientists call entrainment, that process is at work here, where you get...
Oh, yes. And actually, when the baby's in the womb, the first musical concept a fetus does, without knowing it, of course, or as their brain develops, is actually acclimate their vital signs to mother's vitals.
Yeah. So they're entraining, they're becoming entrained to the heartbeat of the mother.
And the uterus.
This whooshing sound in the womb. Wow. So that's Remo, who make a lot of these so-called frame drums. They call this an ocean drum, and I can see why.
Well, actually, Remo came out. His son is a doctor, his wife is a doctor, and they came out and observed.
The guy who runs Mr. Remo.
Mr. Remo. They came out and observed our work, and we felt that the original ocean drum was a bit loud and jarring and snare-like, so they actually made what we call an ocean disc. And the materials in this particular instrument that we use in the NICU is softer. It's called an ocean disc, not an ocean drum.
So this
drum.
Is specifically made for this purpose?
Correct.
Wow. We're speaking with Dr. Joanne Lowy. She's director of Beth Israel's Louis Armstrong Center for Music and Medicine and the leader of this new study called The Effects of Music Therapy on Vital Signs, Feeding, and Sleep in Premature Infants. It was recently published in the journal Pediatrics. All right, so then the other thing, which looks like a kind of familiar, you know, little tongue drum or log drum, that's what you use to mimic the sound of the mother's heartbeat.
So we play this box with our finger rather than a mallet, because a mallet would make it a drum. In this way, creating the sound with our finger is a human way, much like the heartbeat. And it's an enclosed sound, much like the baby would hear in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
So it's soft.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that's one of the, I mean, in looking through the study, one of the things that struck me that I had never thought about before is a neonatal ICU, a NICU, as you referred to it a moment ago, is a noisy place.
And it can be.
And that, you know, we know that noise can be a very important stressor for adults and for premature infants, you know, it's probably equally, if not more so.
Yes, it's been written in the journal produced by the American Academy of Pediatrics. I'd say in the past 10 years, there's been a few articles on the hindrances of noise in NICUs. It's a problem.
Well, this is, I mean, just a little bit of sound here of a neonatal intensive care unit. Not sure what hospital this is from, but these sounds, you'll find them everywhere. Joanne, that almost sounds like Times Square traffic or something.
Yeah, very dissonant chords.
Yeah. Dr. Joanne Lowy is here with me in the studio on Soundcheck today. So is Julia Summers, who's an intern at Beth Israel's Louis Armstrong Center for Music and Medicine. And Julia, you actually do some of the singing, the lullabies that are part of this effort?
Yeah, absolutely. We put into action Joanne's techniques in the NICU and work with the mothers and the babies and the fathers as well.
All right, Joanne, I know you know the music therapist Connie Tomaino, who's been on our show a number of times, and she has talked about doing music therapy, especially for older people, where the key to it is to find the music that they love. Now, with someone who has a lifetime of experience of listening to music, that makes a certain kind of sense. With a premature infant who hasn't had that kind of rich history of music, how do you determine what music is going to work for each individual?
Well, we are certified music therapists, and in the Journal of Music and Medicine, of which I'm co-editor-in-chief, a lot of the preferences now we're seeing from the authors is to have the music match the culture. So the way that you do it is you focus on the life world of the family. You ask a father and mother, you do music therapy with them and get them calm and see what elements and what melodies have been passed down from one generation to the next. Or is it a melody from their wedding? Or is it from their church or synagogue? What's going to be the song of kin is what I call it, the holy melody.
But, you know, if it's a song from mom and dad's wedding, it's not likely to be a lullaby, is it?
Not always. We've had some challenging favorite requests come in, but as music therapists, we're trained to work with the elements of music so we can change virtually any song into a lullaby.
All right. Give us an example, Julia, Joanne, of how you would put this into practice. What's a song that you've used recently?
Well, Julia Summers, our wonderful intern, was working with one of the parents, and she was given a sort of fast-tempoed song that sounded, it was in 4-4, more of a march-like rock and roll tempo, and it, what we'd like to do is play you it in original form and then show you how we shifted it into a lullaby.
All right.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. You'd be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived, and I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you.
So that's how it came in.
Right.
That's how the mother loved it.
And then the chorus gets even louder and
more
sort of brazen and brassy sounding. Not the thing you want for a premature infant who's struggling with noise and stuff. So, all right, Julia, Joanne, show me how this gets turned into a lullaby and used in the music therapy that you do there at the neonatal unit. Familiar tune turned into a lullaby. Dr. Joanne Lowy playing the guitar, Julia Summers singing. They're both working at Beth Israel's Louis Armstrong Center for Music and Medicine. Dr. Joanne Lowy is the director, and Julia Summers is an intern there. And we're talking about the study called The Effects of Music Therapy on Vital Signs, Feeding, and Sleep in Premature Infants, recently published in the journal Pediatrics. And Julia, you're close to the microphone, so I can hear you audibly breathing between phrases and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of the, I mean, is the baby supposed to hear that too? Is that part of the entrainment that Joanne was talking about
Absolutely.
Before?
Absolutely, yeah. It's the breath is really important when working with premature infants, either to provide that kind of stable sound and using entrainment to match that breath and then move it to elongated sound.
Mm. And Joanne, is the point to teach the parents to sing the song this way as well so that when they go home, they can continue this sort of music therapy?
Yeah, the problem is we're living in a gadget society with iPods and iPads and great, you walk in any baby store and there's a million CDs. So parents think, particularly when doctors endorse CDs, that they just throw on a CD and let the baby go to sleep. What they don't realize is that their bodies are valuable instruments.
So it's not enough to have a recording of something soft and sleepy and, you know,
The recording can't change meter of respiration or heart rate.
Huh. But the human interaction from music therapists or parents can.
Yes, and we teach the parents how to do this.
Wow. Dr. Joanne Lowy is director of Beth Israel's Louis Armstrong Center for Music and Medicine and leader of the new study that we've been talking about on the effect of music on premature babies, and Julia Summers, an intern at that same program. And they've been with us here on Soundcheck today. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Coming up all this week, we're asking for your Iggy Pop stories in advance of our special webcast of an Iggy and the Stooges concert this Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m. Eastern. We'll hear a few of those Iggy Pop memories next, and a live performance from writer and musician Carl Hancock Rux. This is Soundcheck. This week on Soundcheck, we're knee-deep in the music of Iggy Pop. You can visit soundcheck.org to hear a stream of the new album, Ready to Die, from the punk icon. And this coming Sunday, Iggy Pop and the Stooges will be here in New York performing that new record, plus some old favorites, and we will be webcasting the whole thing live. Now, he is one of rock's most notorious frontmen, and he's definitely left a strong impression. And we are asking for yours. Got an Iggy Pop story? You can call us at 866-939-1612 and leave us a voicemail. You can tweet us at Soundcheck or post your story on the website, soundcheck.org. Now, we've invited a few folks to join us with their stories right now. Kind of quickie Iggy Pop roundtable. And we'll start with our good friend Sophie Harris from Time Out New York. Hi, Sophie.
Hey, John.
Sophie, quick word association. Tell me the first word that comes to mind when I say Iggy Pop.
I'm going to go with Butch.
Butch. All right, yeah. let me come back. Ty Siegel, the musician, garage punk musician, whose latest album is called Twins, is on the line with us from San Francisco, California. Ty, first question to you is the same question. Word association. First word that comes to mind when I say Iggy Pop.
I just think God. That's what I think.
God. Butch, yeah. And all right. Also with us on the line, Sylvie Simmons, the music journalist, whose most recent book is I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen.
Fearless.
Okay, that's a good one. And also with us on the line is Sarah Everton, musician in the Philadelphia-based band Bleeding Rainbow. She's calling us from the touring van. Sarah, you got a word association for us with Iggy Pop?
Yeah, I would say scar tissue.
I will allow the two words as one.
You can hyphenate it. It counts.
Okay. But what we really asked all of you on the show for today is to share your Iggy Pop memories. Sylvie, let's start with you.
Okay. I was interviewing Iggy Pop in Paris, and I should add that he was sitting there reading a very intellectual book and wearing the identical pair of fishnet tights that I was wearing. So we had a kind of very good bonding experience there. And we were talking a bit about radishes and growing plants. I don't know how that came about, and I don't know how this story came about. But here's the story. Somehow Leonard Cohen's name came up. And he said, I have a story about Leonard. He said, I was in Los Angeles recording an album when Leonard Cohen phoned me up one night, and he said, Iggy, come over. I've got a personal ad from a girl who says she wants a lover who will combine the raw energy of Iggy Pop with the elegant wit of Leonard Cohen. I think all women would want that, really. Anyway, Leonard Cohen decided they should reply to this woman as a team. And so he went over and got together with Iggy, who was doing an album with Don Was. And Don Was took a photograph of the two of them in the kitchen, both looking very pouty and you know, exactly what a girl would want when they put an ad like that in the paper. And so he replied. And so I asked Iggy, did you reply? Did you go on a date with her, the both of you? And Iggy said, no, I didn't, but I think Leonard did.
So that is quite a story, Sylvie.
Absolutely. And as I say, the ideal man, a bit butch, as Sophie said, fearless, and our Mr. Fantastic Poet, Leonard Cohen.
All right, Sylvie Simmons. Her latest book is I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen. Thanks for the story, Sylvie.
My pleasure.
Let's move on to Ty Siegel. You know, you kind of work in a style that's descended from Iggy. What's your story? What's your main memory of him?
Well, I've never met him or seen him. I hope to, but the thing about Iggy is he's kind of like this this god for kids who don't believe in God, and the same with rock and roll, and he's the best it gets, you know. Mm-hmm. For young kids, like when I was 13 is when I heard Rock Power the first time, and I have a very distinct memory of walking into this record store, and I was a young kid just getting into punk. I think I had a Black Flag CD, mm-hmm. and I had a Minor Threat CD, but I walked in, and the clerk was listening to Raw Power, and it was just kind of this perfect moment of this like dude just laying down the gospel.
Love in the middle of a firefight. Well, I gotta strike this man. Somebody gotta save my soul. Baby, better take my life. A little bit of Search and Destroy from the album Raw Power, 1973 classic from Iggy Pop. We're asking a small crew of musicians and writers for their Iggy Pop memories. Back to you, Sophie Harris. What's your big memory of Iggy Pop?
Yeah, I guess it was probably about 6 or 7 years ago, a Mojo Awards ceremony. And we were each entrusted with a rock star to chaperone for the night. And I was looking after Arcade Fire. And I was standing near the bar with Wyn Butler, having a little chat. And
the very tall lead singer and songwriter.
Indeed, very, very tall. And we were, I guess, a few meters away from the bar. And standing at the bar was Iggy Pop. And I think he might have been talking to Bjork at the time. And so I was standing a little ways away talking to Wyn. And we'd be chatting, and every so often he'd look over at the bar at Iggy, and I'd say, do you want to go over and talk to him? Because I could, you know, introduce you and whatever. And he'd say, no, that's fine. And then a couple of minutes later, he'd kind of glance over at the bar again, and I'd be, you sure? Do you want to go and chat to Iggy? No, it's fine. And I guess it just went on for a while, and I don't know, it just tickled me because it's such a good illustration of the magnetism of Iggy, you know, because I was staring too, and as I remember it, Iggy was shirtless, although that could just be my mind colouring it in, but you just can't help but stare, you know?
Mm-hmm. All right, so a kind of formidable figure, even to someone like Wyn Butler of Arcade Fire. Thanks very much, Sophie.
Thank you.
And last but not least, Sarah Everton from the band Bleeding Rainbow. Sarah, what's your memory? What's your Iggy Pop story?
The first time I ever saw Iggy Pop, I had no idea who he was. It was on the TV show The Adventures of Pete and Pete, which aired on Nickelodeon in the early 90s. He was a reoccurring character. He played the father of one of the Pete's friends, Nona Mecklenburg. He was James Pop Mecklenburg. I remember watching the show and having no idea who he was. And now looking back on it, it's really hilarious. He plays like a really like sweet, like overprotective father. And it's really funny because that show was meant for kids, but it was definitely meant for adults too. It's meant for like cool parents that would like know who he was and get why it was so funny.
I'm going to have to check this show out, The Adventures of Pete and Pete.
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's a cult classic.
All right. Sarah Everton on tour with the band Bleeding Rainbow. Enjoy the rest of the tour, Sarah, and thanks for pointing us in this direction. We're going to hear a little bit from The Adventures of Pete and Pete and Iggy Pop in character as the dad, James Mecklenburg.
Excuse me, folks. It looks like the dance is nearing an end, and I wanted to send out a special message to my little pookie, Nona Mecklenburg. Maybe after she hears it, she'll give her pop one lousy dance.
I held you on my bended knee. I tucked you in the sack. I carried you around so much, I sprained my lower back. And now I see you standing there, a little girl no more.
Well, that is pretty damn funny. And to anyone who's ever watched Iggy Pop writhing as if boneless on or below the stage, the idea of him spraining his back as he sings in that little ditty is really funny. All right, folks, got an Iggy Pop story? You can call us at 866-939-1612 and leave us a voicemail. Tweet us at Soundcheck or post your story online at soundcheck.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The poet and novelist Carl Hancock Rux considers the written word to be a kind of performance art. And I don't mean standing up and reciting a poem. I mean really performing, like with a band. It's actually a tradition that goes back to poets like the late Allen Ginsberg and possibly all the way back to Homer. Carl Hancock Rux's latest album is called Homeostasis, and he and members of his band are here in the studio to play some of it for us live on Soundcheck. Here's the title track, Carl Hancock Rux, on Soundcheck. Carl Hancock Rux and the title track from his forthcoming record called Homeostasis in a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio by some, but not all, of Carl Hancock Rux's band. We heard Ben Tyree playing the electric guitar, Lon Kaiser at our piano, and Hamilton Kirby playing the laptop, which enabled us to get the full sound, Carl,
exactly.
Even though it's just a portion of the band today. First of all, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Am I saying homeostasis right?
Yes, or homeostasis.
Okay.
Stasis, stasis, tomato, tomato.
Your words. At what point does music come into the process of composing these pieces?
For this record, it came in from the beginning. I was sitting with the pianist who's here tonight, Lon Kaiser, and I was at his home, and I'd just been listening to a lot of Frank Sinatra records, and I'd been listening to and reading books and reading about orchestrations and Nelson Riddle and arrangements and all of these things. And I thought, okay, I'd like to make a new record, but I don't want to make a record like the other records that I'd made. I wanted to give more space to music. I wanted poetry to have its place. But I didn't want it to dominate.
Okay. It's a kind of music that incorporates obvious elements of jazz, electronic music, folk, contemporary classical, with such a wide range. I mean, is that driven by the text as well? How are those decisions made?
I think it's driven by my life experience. I can never get away from, I guess, sort of loving so many different kinds of music and wanting to see how they all live in the same room, and how they move, how they help move music forward, or move me forward, So, I mean, I am a big fan of jazz, a big fan of classical, a big fan of R&B sometimes, a big fan of soul, a big fan of hip-hop, all those things. And so I think that whenever I walk into a room, even if somebody says, or even if I say, I'm going to make a record that is absolutely a folk record, it comes out like a electronica, classical, jazz, no matter what.
Well, and some of the people you work with, guitarist Vernon Reed, the pianist Vijay Iyer, the singers Nona Hendricks and Martha Redbone, I mean, these are people who you just can't sort of contain them in any one part of the music world. We actually started with a little bit of your song called Silence Speaks Softly, which featured Martha Redbone.
Mm-hmm.
Whose own last record was an Americana disc built around the poetry of William Blake.
Absolutely.
Now, that was her singing over the phone to you in the studio?
Absolutely. I was in the studio, and I said to myself, I want a female voice on this. And I was, joking around in the studio, kind of doing my own Billie Holiday impersonations or whatever.
Impressions. What? You're what?
I do these Billie Holiday impressions.
Okay, we're going to hear one now.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yes, come on.
Silent
trees.
So I was doing my own circa 1959. So
Billie Holiday on an off night.
On an off night, right. So I called Martha on the phone while we were in the studio, and I said, and I sang her this line that I'd written, but me impersonating Billie Holiday, and said, okay, don't do what I did, but make it better. And she started to sing, and then I just put the phone to the mic, and we recorded her that way.
Well, we're speaking with Carl Hancock Rux. The fruits of his labor can be heard on his fourth record called Homeostasis, which comes out on April 30th. The album has a number of songs, Carl, that take on big topics, which is something you've tackled as long as I've known you. The song Trouble seems to be a kind of, not so much a political commentary as a commentary on political commentary, the doublespeak and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it was. I mean, I wrote that. I wrote that poem before I was thinking about this record, and I was writing it around the time of the presidential, election, and just being bombarded with, what the Republicans were saying, what the Democrats were saying, what the newscasters were saying, what everybody was saying, the things that are on Facebook, what everybody's responding to, that we're in trouble, that we're not in trouble, that we're going to be okay, that we're not okay, that, and all these things. And I thought, in a way, my God, we actually sound schizophrenic, you know. There seems to be no agreement. I didn't want to make a commentary about what the politics of the nation are as much as I wanted to make a commentary about what the psychology of being political can be, especially in a time of elections.
Where the political discourse seems to go for the lowest common denominator.
Right.
All right, you want to do Trouble for us?
I'd love to.
All right, I'd love to hear it. It's one of my favorite tracks off the forthcoming record by Carl Hancock Rux. The album is called Homeostasis, and once again, members of Carl Hancock Rux's band performing live here in the Soundcheck studio. This poem/song is called Trouble.
I say we are in trouble. I say we are determined to regain your trust, to be sure our troubles are real. We are in trouble. I believe though we are in trouble, we are not in real trouble. We must not succumb to some trouble, to the gloom-doomed diatribe of economic failure or corporate collapse. The last minute million, billion, trillion dollar bailout of people in trouble. We who are deployed, and all of you who make us unemployed, we are in trouble. We are. We are. Sacked and subsidized without insurance, we are in trouble. Though our troubles are real, we are not really in trouble. I have no trouble with the growing, glowing anti-American sentiment that troubles our nation. It is trouble. We are in trouble. I have no trouble with the trouble of double talk and the walk of aggressive foreign policies or the frustrations of troubled relations. Let us not forget our troubles. Social unrest at the behest of price fluctuations, the war zone of peasantry. I believe we are in trouble. In the trouble of a non-existent labor force, the inflation of financial turmoil, on soil ripe with discouraged initiatives. Yes, it is troubling, but our troubles are not real. We are not in any real trouble. I believe in trouble, in the recessionary fires and the dire aftermath of class and carelessness, lest we forget our troubles. I went to bed and slept through the dysfunctional infrastructure of an impassionate, dispassionate enterprise. I believe we can do anything as long as we know we are in trouble. I believe we can do anything. We must not bail out a troubled nation without imposing tax cuts to capitalists whose fists are all up against the wall and our finances all unsupported efforts left to trouble wherever it is. The initiative is trouble. I said we are in trouble. Can we be ourselves in trouble without running for cover? Our days of trouble are over. We must inflate the deflated morale of a hospitable nation and reinvigorate the will to distill and dissuade and reduce any and all reliance on God or goodwill. Still, we are in trouble. We are in trouble. We are in trouble. Reason. The privileged few who do not know the poverty rate, who do not frustrate the state, should remain that way. We should allow our wealth to trickle down like a drop of spit. We should sit reliant upon this trouble. We are in trouble, but we are not in any real trouble. My trouble with trouble is the failure of the petrochemical and oil industries and widespread reluctance of people to believe in the days of cotton, sugar, and slaves. That way of timber and rice and deforestation of pine and paper pulp, which was the gulf of our nation once? Yes, we are in trouble. No, we're not in trouble. We're not in trouble. We're not in trouble. We're not in any real trouble.
Song is called Trouble, a troubling song from Carl Hancock Rux, which will appear on his new record, Homeostasis, out on April 30th, but you've heard a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio by members of his band. Carl, just quickly, homeostasis, the idea of, you know, maintaining a stable environment.
Exactly.
Equilibrium.
Yes, maintaining balance.
That's got to be your career goal with,
that's my, you know,
as a novelist, poet, singer, songwriter,
and as a human,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
as a person. I think we, it's so easy to think that you are maintaining balance, and it's so easy to think that maintaining balance itself is an easy task. Mm. And it's not necessarily. It takes some work, and it takes some meditation and some concentration, and of course discourse.
Well, and you're looking forward to the new novel and a new opera, both coming up later this year.
Very excited. Yes, absolutely.
All right. Good luck with striking that balance, maintaining that equilibrium there. Carl Hancock Rux with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Carl, nice to see you again. Thank
it's
you so much.
Good to see you.
More music from Carl Hancock Rux, the song called Razor and Blade. If you like what you heard today, check us out on our website for an extra song that Carl and his band recorded here in the studio. It's at soundcheck.org. Speaking of live music, we just made a few more tickets available for tomorrow night's performance by hip-hop artist Talib Kweli in the Green Space here at WNYC. If you want to see Talib performing songs from his new album before it gets released next month, it's happening tomorrow night at 9 p.m. in the Green Space. For tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. Here's a bit from Talib's upcoming album, Prisoner of Conscience. This track is called Push Through. When I'm on fire, she always try to douse me. Only reason that you make it rain is because your diamond's cloudy. I see you from a mile away when it get overcast. Old people feel it in their bones. Fade your home like a broken glass. That's Talib Kweli. Come see him tomorrow night in the Green Space, 9 p.m. For tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. Up next, life with hyperacusis, the condition characterized by an extreme oversensitivity to sound. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We've talked quite a bit in the past here on the program about the condition known as tinnitus. It often manifests itself as a ringing or whooshing sound in the ears and can be caused by a variety of things, one of which is exposure to loud sounds. But today, we're learning about a lesser-known and, frankly, even scarier condition that's perhaps related to tinnitus. It's called hyperacusis. Joyce Cohen recently wrote about it for BuzzFeed. She joins me now on the phone. Joyce, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, John. Thank you.
Yeah, you not only wrote about hyperacusis, you wrote about living with it yourself. How do you explain this condition to other people, who many of whom have never heard of it?
It's kind of impossible to explain. Maybe the easiest way to explain it is the opposite of deafness. So instead of sounds sounding softer, it's that sounds sound louder. There's also a lowered threshold of pain, so that sounds are louder and painful.
Hmm. Now, when did you start noticing the condition, and how did it sort of progress?
I had some noise exposure. It was about 6 years ago. And the bad thing or the difficult thing about this is noise exposure or noise trauma is like sunburn or food poisoning. There's a delayed reaction, and there are very, very few warning signs. I actually had an event. I felt a wave of pressure descend upon my head. I felt something happen inside my head. A lot of other people don't have an identifiable event. They have cumulative noise exposure. One day they wake up with hyperacusis, or they sort of gradually notice that sounds are painful or their noise tolerance is lower. Then they might have another noise exposure, a secondary noise exposure, and it worsens.
Mm. Now, how extreme is your condition? I mean, you live here in New York. You could physically be here with me in the studio, except our studio isn't carpeted.
Yeah, you've sort of asked two questions.
Yeah.
I am, I think, the outlier among outliers. I'm probably one of the most severe, or I probably had been one of the most severe cases. I requested to do this on the telephone because acoustic environments are important. I'm okay in a carpeted room or a room with a lot of soft surfaces. A room with a hard floor or a room with a lot of hard surfaces is very acoustically harsh and unforgiving, and I didn't think it would be easy for me to be in the studio with you because of that.
Yeah, so what types of sounds actually cause you pain?
Well, typically, the hardest sounds are low throbs and high pitches. For example, the crosstown bus has low throbs, and that's very, very difficult. But, of course, I wear hearing protection on the bus, which is another story. When I was injured, reading the newspaper was difficult because the newspaper crackled, and there was pain shot through my ears. If the cat meowed, it was pain in my ears. If I went outside in the morning and there were birds in the trees in the spring, now it's the sort of thing that if I'm walking down the sidewalk and there's a delivery man with a bicycle chain clanking, that's the kind of sound, a sort of percussive sound. But the real problem is you can't anticipate sound. So in my case, I make sure my ears are protected whenever I'm in an uncontrolled sound environment.
Mm. Now, we have a word for this, hyperacusis. So, you know, there must be doctors who are aware of it, but it sounds like for many sufferers of hyperacusis, when they go to a doctor, an ear, nose, and throat specialist, that they're met with this sort of baffled, it must be all in your head kind of thing.
Yeah, well, you're told you're crazy, basically. You're told that this can't possibly be the case, that the ear can't possibly produce this kind of pain, which is completely wrong. I think they all learn the same thing in doctor school, and audiologists all learn the same thing in audiology school, and it's just dead wrong. ENTs are actually the wrong kind of doctor. I mean, there is no kind of doctor. But ENTs do things like sleep apnea and cochlear implants and thyroid cancer. There is actually nothing that's known about this, or rather there's so little that's known about this that doctors generally can't help. Doctors often cause harm. A lot of times they'll give you certain tests that put loud noises in your ear that can worsen you. Sometimes they'll order an MRI. An MRI isn't going to show anything, and an MRI is horrifically loud. An MRI is like having a jackhammer at your head for an hour. People who have this can worsen very, very easily with noise, and so they're at sustained risk, and ears don't heal well. So that anyone who has a kind of noise injury is at a very real risk of worsening if they're exposed to any noise above their tolerance. So people should really be alert to that.
Does anybody know what's actually, I'm not sure how much research, Joyce, has been done on hyperacusis, but does anybody know what's actually happening in the ear that is causing such pain?
No idea.
Is anybody looking into it? Is there a foundation? Is there a support mechanism for people with hyperacusis?
There's a new nonprofit. It's called Hyperacusis Research. It can be found online at hyperacusisresearch.org. And they had their very first presentation for the Association for Research in Otolaryngology on noise-induced pain. And they're starting with research. They've taken the first step, which is a review of literature, and my belief is that all the literature is dead wrong.
Hmm. Now, there is or was a message board for people with hyperacusis, because you write in your article for BuzzFeed that that's how you met your husband, who also suffers from the condition.
Yes, I wrote on BuzzFeed that we met uncute. We met on a message board. If people ask me how we met, I say we met on a message board for people with catastrophic ear injuries. And he emailed me because I was getting better and he was getting worse, and he wanted to know what I was doing to get better.
So have both of those trajectories continued, or have you both sort of leveled off?
Yes, both have continued. I continue to improve. I'm very, very careful to stay within my noise tolerance and not to expose myself to any noise. If I do get exposed to noise above my tolerance, it's a big problem. I was exposed to very, very brief construction noise, and it took about 6 months to recover from that. My husband has had a series of noise insults, and sometimes they're very, very hard to prevent because you can't anticipate noise, and he has only worsened. So basically, he has a chronic pain condition.
Wow. And so how do you treat that?
My husband is treating it with pain medication.
So that's you can treat the symptom, but not the cause.
Yeah, there is some kind of treatment which may work in mild cases. It's a kind of sound therapy. It involves listening to white noise or pink noise. There's a great website, simplynoise.com. The most soothing noise is brown noise. People often find that soothing to listen to.
Mm-hmm. Well, white noise and pink noise are fairly well known. I've never heard of brown noise. What is that?
Brown noise is less hissy, so it has a lot of the high frequencies taken out or reduced. So it's much more soothing. Think of a cat's purr. That is not unsimilar to brown noise.
We're speaking with Joyce Cohen, a BuzzFeed contributor, New York Times real estate writer. Her piece about hyperacusis for BuzzFeed is available on our website at soundcheck.org. I have to warn you, though, it is it makes for, I found, very troubling reading. Especially since, Joyce, you detail two separate instances of people with hyperacusis committing suicide because they simply can't live with the pain anymore. You know, when it gets to that kind of state, you would think the medical industry would take notice and begin to kind of look into this. Now, it sounds like from what you're saying that there is this hyperacusisresearch.org, but is that... Are those doctors? Is that medical research that's being done?
Researchers are the starting point, and it takes a while for the research to filter down to the doctors, but we are so much in the dark ages about this that it's hard to think that there's going to be any kind of treatment or cure in any sort of reasonable time frame. But I want to correct you. There were actually three young men who committed suicide. There was one who was mentioned very briefly. His suicide was in 1996, and he was misdiagnosed with a jaw problem. Often this is misdiagnosed as an ear infection or a jaw problem. And back then, nobody had any clue. And I think with the Internet, people who have these weird conditions that no one's ever heard of are able to gather.
Right. So that at least gives you a place, as you and your husband found out, to, you know, commiserate and share experiences. But without the prospect of treatment or a cure in the near future, what do you think needs to happen for people like yourself and your husband to be able to just, like, you know, live in the world, let alone live in New York City?
Well, a few things. In New York City, people think it's loud, and it is loud, but other places are loud, too. As I mentioned in the story, in the suburbs, you have lawn care equipment, which is just horrific. There are also a lot of barking dogs there. In the country, there are insects and there are birds. In the city, in my situation, because I know I'm going to be subjected to a lot of loud noise, I always protect my ears. I have industrial-strength earmuffs, so I look like the baggage handler. Mm-hmm. But without those, I couldn't go outside because the noise would be too painful.
And even in the country, I mean, if you were to go live on top of a mountain somewhere, just the wind in the trees and the birds and the insects, that would be a sonic environment that would still be painful?
Probably. I haven't tested it out, but probably. What I find is because noise is so difficult to anticipate, it's much better to be prepared. If an unexpected noise comes along, you can stick your fingers in your ear, but by that time it's too late.
Yeah.
So if you're always prepared, that's sort of a safer way to go.
So Joyce, this is such an enormous issue with, you know, major complications for the lives of people who suffer from this condition, hyperacusis. I kind of hate to end on such a kind of pragmatic note, but I'm curious, how is it that you're able to talk to me on the phone and not have that be a problem?
Well, I'm lucky enough that I was always able to talk on the phone, although I don't like cell phones, which have a very harsh acoustic quality. There are little tricks you can use on the phone. You can sort of hold the phone not away from your ear. It's better to tip it away from your ear so the sound is facing away. Or you can put your fingers over the ear holes. Of course, I'm talking about a regular landline phone.
Right,
I've actually heard of people. I've heard of people who take a cloth or a washcloth and rubber band it around the earpiece. But I'd also like to add that I refuse to sugarcoat. I know my story was very grim, and I wanted to make sure that my story was very grim because the situation is very grim.
It's a grim story, but a very memorable one, Joyce, and I will not soon forget it. And thank you for spending some time with us and talking about hyperacusis on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Tomorrow on the show, Steve Martin, yes, that's Steve Martin, and Edie Brickell have teamed up for a new album. They'll play some of it live in our studio. And this month marks the 30th anniversary of Murmur, the debut album from the band R.E.M. To celebrate, sort of, Aaron Brophy of Spinner has ranked the band's entire catalog, all 15 studio albums, from worst to first. And you might be surprised by the R.E.M. album that tops his list. Plus, find out how to attend our show with Iggy and the Stooges here in New York City, and more of your Iggy Pop stories. We want to hear your story about seeing Iggy, hearing Iggy, or attempting to be like Iggy. Leave it on our voicemail at 866-939-1612, tweet us at Soundcheck, or post it on our site at soundcheck.org. That does it for tonight's show. See you back here tomorrow night at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.